struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, Travis Johnson here, the Nonprofit Architect, here today with Kate Redfern, the founder of Adansonia Consulting. Today, we're going to touch on such riveting topics as change management, stakeholders, and how to really pay and attract the best employees. Kate, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you, Travis. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Why don't you tell us some cool stuff about Adansonia Consulting, how you got there, and what you do?
Sure. So it's Adansonia Consulting, and it's named after a tree from a nature reserve where I grew up in Botswana, which is more colloquially known as the baobab tree, also known as the tree of life. They live to about 3,000 years old, but really they're the center of community. Everything in the desert subsists and lives off of this tree, which provides and gives, and everything that interacts with each other. It has a symbiotic relationship with this tree. And so that's where I took my inspiration for the name, because I really believe in being community focused. I have a consulting agency that consults specifically to nonprofits. We work exclusively with nonprofits on strategic planning, change management, organizational development, and fundraising program and plan design and execution.
Yeah, it's really cool. And you've been in the business for most of your adult life, is that right?
Yeah, actually, I've been in the business since I was 12 as a volunteer. I started off in wildlife rehab as a volunteer for a nonprofit. I was a junior ambassador for the World Wildlife Fund. And then as an adult, I went into corporate marketing and found a lot more enjoyment doing the volunteer work that I was doing with nonprofits. And so I just launched into working with nonprofits. If I was going to work hard, I wanted it to be to make a difference in my community, not to be passionate about selling legal textbooks or laundry detergent. Yeah, so I've been a volunteer, I've been a staff member, I've been a board member, so still have some of those roles. But yeah, love working in the nonprofit sector.
Yeah, I don't think I could be very passionate about selling laundry detergent.
Right, yeah.
That just wouldn't work for me. What do you mean by change management? Is that just like the growth of an organization, or is that like something like COVID that comes along and just wipes out all your plans?
There's two parts to that. I think the first part is strategic planning. All organizations, I believe, should have some kind of strategic plan that outlines what they want to achieve in the next 5 years, and that takes into account the environment and the landscape within which you operate. You do your best to kind of guess at what changes are going to be coming down the line in the next couple of years, and plan accordingly. And then you get hit with something like COVID, which is somewhat of a black swan event. There are organizations that track these things that could have told us that a global pandemic was going to hit us in the next 5 to 10 years. But in terms of our daily reality, that's not at the forefront of most of our minds. And so change management in any kind of situation is really just navigating a change in organizational operations, either in response to a change within the organization or outside of the organization, so that you can continue to deliver your programs and services in the most effective way. With regard to COVID, I think that change management has been largely reactive for the first 3 months, where people are just trying to kind of figure out how to continue meeting the needs of their clients while they're working in this environment that is so vastly different from where they were in February, for example. Even if they had the best laid out continuity and disaster plans, I think most of those are structured towards something like a hurricane or a flood or a fire type event, where it's a fixed term event, it's relatively short, and you're left picking up the pieces in the aftermath, but life around you goes on as normal pretty quickly. We're certainly not in that state right now. I think that we're still navigating our way through the disaster or through the disruption. It's not over yet. So thinking about how we deal with how we deliver programs and services after this pandemic is one thing, but a lot of organizations are still trying to figure out how they remain effective and stay afloat and remain sustainable through this pandemic. And so it really becomes about navigating the changes and being proactive about deciding for yourself as an organization that you're going to lay out a plan for the next 12 months that involves input from all of your stakeholders who are affected, and figuring out how you're going to do that in the most proactive way possible, rather than continuing to try and do things the way that you've always done them with slight adjustments. That's not the most efficient way to do things. So really kind of focusing on what the outcomes are that you still need to achieve and how you can do that within the parameters of a lot of the things that we're dealing with right now.
Oh, I definitely agree. You have to be proactive rather than reactive. But organizations are still out there delivering programs. They're still delivering, you know, goods and services. They're still trying to raise money. But raising money has now shifted to largely an online event. And for those people out there that are scared to, they're just nervous about jumping into the online fundraising scene, what would you tell those individuals?
I think that the fundamental tenets of fundraising have not changed. The way that we have to do it certainly, I think, has changed. And I think that this is a great opportunity for organizations that have not started investing in different types of fundraising to really get away from the transactional type of fundraising that is an in-person event, whether that's a golf day or a gala where the donors get something in return for the purchase of their ticket and attending with some fundraising and kind of a net profit from putting this event on, which delivers revenue for the organization, really to rather changing to a more transformational or inspired form of fundraising, where you are compelling your donors to give to the organization because they really believe in your mission. And the fact that they're not able to participate in an in-person event really doesn't matter to them or impact whether or not they're going to give. I think that I've seen a lot of panic around projected revenue losses from big events, specifically golf days, trivia nights, and galas. But I don't think that that's necessarily funds that are lost. I think that you just need to change the way that you're doing them. And that's not to try and put on a online event in place of an in-person event and try and recreate that experience online. I don't think that you're able to do that. I've seen some really good examples of people who have accomplished something along those lines. But I think it's a perfect opportunity to have the conversations with your donors about what the impact of COVID has been, not engage in crisis fundraising. That's like, that kind of follows the line of, oh my gosh, we're in such trouble. If we don't get your help, we're going to be in even more dire straits and potentially close. But really focus on inspirational fundraising. So being transparent about how you're addressing the changes in program delivery, about how much your clients will need you, about how you're going to be serving them, and then developing the case for investment in that. It's a great time, I think, to push giving societies and also to increase your monthly giving profile. So having people sign up for $5 a month instead of $60 annually is somewhere to start for a lot of people who maybe don't have the funds to put out there. I think the greater threat to fundraising right now is the number of people who supported organizations through smaller donations who are now unable to give because they don't have job security or they have lost their jobs. But on the flip side of that, I've seen other organizations benefit from people who have been able to work remotely, whose jobs are not under threat, and who've taken up the mantle and almost have a sense of feeling really fortunate to have not lost their jobs, seeing what's going on around them, and really stepping up in terms of knowing that organizations still need their support. So where they may not be going on vacation or they may not be going out to eat, they are instead giving those funds to nonprofits. There was a big drive with the stimulus checks for people who were still employed to donate some or part of their stimulus checks to different nonprofits, which was a successful campaign that I saw a lot of organizations undertake. So I think that there's an opportunity to really talk about how much work there is to be done, how much clients still need services, how you've positioned yourself to meet that need, and create an inspiring case to encourage your donors to see themselves as partners investing in change in the community rather than attendees at an event who are going to be asked to make a one-time donation.
When I look at an organization, I hear, you know, the stories they tell and what they highlight and how they do this and how they've changed the narrative over time. I think it's really important to understand that a great way to look at this is that the nonprofit is the guide or the channel that allows the donor really to be the hero in the nonprofit story, in the nonprofit story, that the donors swoop in really and save the day. And the guys are there, the nonprofit is there showing them the way to do so, but you need to have that donor engagement really as part of the story and position them as the heroes, because without the donations coming in, there's nothing that they can get done. And that's what we really need to impact those mission and those people that, that really need in this challenging time.
Yeah, you've hit on a couple of things, a couple of keywords that I like that I think are really important. I do a fundraising messaging training class. I volunteer that for my local SCORE chapter. And one of the things that I talk about is getting away from what I call general passive indirect messaging and instead engaging in specific active direct messaging. And that really is about the nonprofit is the one who does the work. Everybody knows that. But it's about taking an impact qualifier and connecting the donor directly to the outcome rather than connecting them to you as a middleman and the outcome of the client and having those two kind of unrelated. So rather than saying something like $5 donation to a feed pantry feeds one family for 2 days, you could say your $5 donation kept the bellies of two school children full so that they can concentrate on their studies and not the hunger pangs in their belly. You know, that's a really actively and directly connecting the donor to the outcome and removing yourself as the middleman does away with that kind of traditional tired fundraising messaging that says your donation helps us to deliver these programs and services. Your support enables us to. I think that's really kind of passive and indirect and talks about the nonprofit more than it talks about the donor or the client, which is where the focus really needs to be.
Right. So if you had a nonprofit helping rescue and rehabilitate feral cats, you could say that your donations put cats in safe places.
Yes. Or some of that. Yeah. Your donation means that means that one cat came off the streets today and is sleeping safely in a foster home tonight.
I understand that you have a pretty judgmental cat. Is that what, did I hear that correctly?
Yes. Her name is Princess Zina, and she sits in perpetual judgment. I would love to go people watching with her because I think she would be a great snarky conversation partner. But yeah, she sits in perpetual judgment of me and everyone who comes into my house and everything that we do. So she believes that she is the center of the universe, and I'm not going to tell her that she's wrong.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
We spoke earlier about really understanding the stakeholders that are in a nonprofit. And I don't know if everyone looks at this the same way. What do you mean by stakeholders?
So I think a stakeholder is literally that, anyone who holds a stake in the outcome of your organization. So anyone who has influence over or is influenced by the work that you do. So that would include your staff, your volunteers, your clients, your donors, your referring agencies, partners that you collaborate with. They're all considered stakeholders. And one of the things that I see particularly smaller nonprofits struggling with is trying to figure out the most effective way to meet the need of the constituents that they're trying to serve, whether that is people, whether it's animals, whether it's children, whether it's adults, regardless of what sector they're in or who they're trying to serve, they are trying to be the solution to a challenge that are faced by their constituents. And they take the burden of figuring that out 100% onto themselves. So the perception is that because they are the executive team or the program staff that are responsible for developing and executing those programs, they need to be the be-all and end-all of everything in terms of what that looks like. And I'm a big advocate for stakeholder involvement and certainly client-centered program delivery and donor-centered fundraising, where those stakeholders are brought into the planning process and give feedback and ideas in terms of how they think the need can most effectively be met with the resources that you have. That doesn't mean that the tail's wagging the dog necessarily. I think that if it's facilitated correctly, you have everybody coming to the table and being involved in discussions and developments of solutions that are going to work for the people that you're trying to serve within the resources that the organization has and within the scope of the mission as well.
So what does that conversation look like? You call up a donor and you're like, hey, come help us plan this next event. Help us make it better. Is it that easy? Is it that straightforward?
with events, you can involve your donors. You can invite them to serve on committees if they would like. I think donors, especially now, don't want to just be seen as ATMs or people who write checks. They want to know the impact that their donation is having, but I think that they give to you because this is clearly something that matters to them. And if it matters to them, they probably have thoughts about how you can deliver services. So I think that in terms of donors, it's really important to survey your donors. You know who your most invested donors are. And I think that a phone call and letting them know that you are undertaking some kind of program or process review or program development or expansion or trying to figure out how to navigate something that you've not come across before, you can ask the donor for input specifically in terms of how it affects them and how it would make a difference to them. So the conversation that I would have donors would be less about how do you think we should deliver our programs and services, and more about what matters to you, what makes you give to us, can you help us understand why what we do is compelling to you, and what you need to hear from us and what you need to see from us in order to continue supporting our organization. Now, not every donor has the same motivation for giving, but if you talk to enough of them, you're going to get a pretty well-rounded picture of what your donors want to hear from you and what the hook is to get them involved, that when you now work on your fundraising program design or redevelopment, you can tailor it to what your donors have told you matters to them rather than trying to guess.
That's perfect. So now we go from the donors and really understanding what they want and what they look for and what really drives them. How does that conversation change and how is that different for your volunteers?
So volunteers are a really important resource for nonprofits. A lot of nonprofits that I work with would probably not be able to deliver their programs and services without their program volunteers. And there's a lot of them. There's one organization I work with that has 5 program staff, but the program delivery is entirely done by volunteers. And so I think that your volunteers and your clients, along with your program staff, are the people who need to be involved in discussions about program delivery. Especially during a time like now where your clients still have a need, your volunteers maybe have reservations about whether or not it is safe for them to be able to go into a building to work with clients or work on products and services that are going to be delivered to clients. And you have clients who are worried about whether or not they're going to continue getting services and whether or not continuing to receive services is safe for them too. Bring them into that conversation. And that can be asking them things like, what in terms of how we're meeting your need is working for you right now? What are the greatest challenges that you're facing in terms of getting this need met? Do you have any thoughts on anything we could be doing differently that could greatly improve this problem or this challenge that we're trying to meet and resolve? And involve them in that process, and your volunteers also. Ask them sort of similar versions of the same questions with regards to how you deliver your programs and services, and then take that feedback to create programs that work for everybody without trying to guess and then get feedback saying, well, this doesn't work for us. I had an organization, if I could give an example, who they were a spina bifida association. So they served the parents of children with spina bifida. They started in the 70s, and they believed that what the parents most needed from them was help to get funding for medical equipment like catheters, calipers, wheelchairs, walking frames, things of that nature, connecting them to doctors and specialists that could help manage spina bifida for their children. And they found as time progressed that their membership was dropping and their client satisfaction surveys were showing a downward trend in terms of satisfaction. And so we went through all the programs and services that they offered, and I said to them, like, how valuable do they find these programs and services? Like, well, we don't know. This is just what we've always offered. I'm like, well, what are they using and what are they not using? And they didn't know. And I said, well, I think that we really need to focus on how to give them the services that they need. What do they need from an organization that's supporting them? You need to find that out from your clients. And they said to me, how do we do that? I'm like, well, you ask them. And so we did. We did some extensive surveying, and we found that they didn't need any of those things because with the advent of the internet, they were able to find a lot of information that they didn't before. Health insurance mostly covers the cost of the medical equipment they needed. What they needed more than anything else was two things. One was as adults to be able to talk to other adults who knew what they were going through and understand. Because even well-intentioned people, when they don't understand, can be exhausting to talk to. And they wanted somewhere where their children could go without to be involved in play and recreation without having to worry about whether or not somebody else would understand what they need. And so they arranged play dates and summer camps for these kids and support groups for the parents. And that involved date nights for the parents, where parents had a network of other parents that they could call to watch their children for them while they went on a date night once a month, so that they had time to be able to go out, but also know that their child was safe with somebody who knew exactly what they were dealing with. And it was as simple as asking them what they needed.
I think that's fantastic. First off, great example and great story. You have to be able to understand what they actually need. It's one thing to provide something, but as you said, as that need changes, how does the organization need to change and overcome and figure out what really is going to, you know, meet the mail and what they need? You had a very, very polite and very diplomatic way of asking that. Now, if you're dealing with, say, a veteran organization, you'd be like, "Hey, bro, do our services suck or what? Yeah, you're terrible and you're ugly too." You know, and you get different types of feedbacks. But then you moved into, you know, finding people that speak the same language. Now, I love my wife, but she has no clue what I'm talking about when I start going in my military acronyms and technobabble and all that speak. So I find it, she's like, "I don't understand why you're just connecting so well with this group of people." Like, well, we speak the same language. You know, if you've been listening for a while, you understand that I've been in Bahrain. I started the podcast over in Bahrain. And although they do speak English, there's not a lot of the same types of westernization. So some things, you know, fell through the cracks. But when you're dealing with different communities, it could be teachers talking to teachers. It could be police officers talking to police officers. It could be therapists talking to therapists. Understanding and having a place for people to come together and speak the language they need to speak is just so valuable and really just really powerful.
Absolutely. And I think another example is an organization that I work with. They teach English to immigrants and refugees, and they teach English in the home. And with the pandemic, obviously in-home teaching was something that couldn't happen anymore. So they tried to go virtual. There was some success with that. But the conversation was constantly around, how do we still teach English? How do we still connect and teach English? How do we still connect and teach English? And when we got down to it and we started speaking to the clients, they were telling, some of them said to us that the interaction with an English speaking person in their community was really important for them to feel a part of that community and not feel a sense of isolation. And so they were really struggling with not having this person in their home or having the kind of more interpersonal interaction that comes around meeting with someone in person and the warmth that comes with that. So they instituted virtual conversation nights where a bunch of students could get together with some volunteer teachers. The teachers are all volunteers in groups of no more than 10. And they have conversations in Zoom where it all has to happen in English because their home language or their first language are all different. But they have a very stilted conversation in English, but they feel like they're part of a community of other people who are going through what they're going through. And they're connected to somebody in the community that, even though it may not be directly related to what they're going through, can help connect them to other services that they may need. And so I think I cannot underscore enough how important it is to get client feedback. And I will tell you this, that as hard as it is to hear that you're not doing well or to hear pretty significant criticism or to get a lot of responses that have some kind of criticism, that is when your most transformational work happens. That's the thing that is most valuable, is when people are not happy and they can express why. And you then change that conversation into, well, how do we change that? And what do we do to address that? And they're involved in that process. And I think also that a lot of clients come from a place of need. It may be financial need, it may be some other kind of resource, it may be emotional, it may be a mental health need, whatever it is, they come with some kind of need, and involving them in the process of planning and developing solutions to meet that need is really important. Because I think that when I read a really interesting article recently that I wholeheartedly agree with, and it's that innovation, your necessity is the mother of invention. And I think that having an unmet need and a lack of something is also a mother of innovation. And so lack is kind of a catalyst for innovation. And so when you get a group of people who experience the same thing, who come from different backgrounds and who have different perspectives on how that need can be solved, it really opens up and expands the horizons in terms of the things that you can do to meet that need that you may not have thought about. Because as somebody sitting there as a program manager or an executive director, you're looking at it through a very different lens from somebody who's receiving a service from you and knows how that impacts their life and how that fits into the puzzle that is them living their daily life. And so the solutions that they're going to come up with and the perspectives that they have are different and I think also valuable.
It's funny you mentioned perspective. We're at a place in our country right now where a large portion of the population is not happy with other portions of the population, but the other portion of the population, they didn't even know it was still a problem, a lot of them. And right. From the different perspectives, you're like, what are you talking about? We solved this thing. It's in documents. It's written. It's been voted on. It's been passed. It's solved. And the other side's like, well, you don't see what we see. And that's definitely an interesting point of perspective. A lot of the conversations I've been having in the last probably month really have been focused around a couple different things. One is dispelling myths. Like, just came up this week. Oh, I know if I start a nonprofit, I have to spend everything by the end of the year. I can't have carryover. That's not true at all. You actually accrue money and pile it up for a rainy day, like we mentioned earlier. But the other big kind of question and myth, it becomes like actually paying your people in a nonprofit a worthwhile wage and not letting them survive on scraps or minimum wage. How do you approach this in a nonprofit that's growing and they're looking to get their first hire or actually pay their executive director? How do you talk them through this process?
So I think that there's two parts to that answer. I think the first is a bigger conversation that needs to be had throughout the entire nonprofit sector. And that conversation is happening. And that conversation is about acknowledging that nonprofits do not deliver resources without people. Every single one of us who has worked in nonprofit has had that donor say, here's a check, whether it's for $20 or $20,000. Here's a check, but you cannot use it on salaries, or you can only use a portion on salaries. People are the people who deliver the programs, right? And so if you want your nonprofit, if you're as a donor, want your nonprofit that you're supporting to do really well, you need to understand that they've got to be able to attract the talent with the skills and the expertise and the training and the passion that's needed to be able to deliver that program. And you're only going to attract talent that you're going to retain if the offering is competitive enough for them to want to be there. Just because somebody works for a nonprofit doesn't mean that they have to work for minimum wage or that they're not allowed to have aspirations to go on vacation or save for retirement or have good health insurance or take care of their children live in a nice house. I don't think that I've seen any nonprofit salaries that are ridiculously exorbitant, but I've certainly seen a lot of nonprofit payrolls where people are not getting paid anywhere near what they would be in the corporate world. And I think that we could tentatively say, and I don't like saying this, but tentatively say that nonprofit salaries probably aren't going to match corporate salaries soon, but I think that that's something we should be working towards. It's going to take a long time to close that gap, though. I mean, initially, I think just understanding that these people as human beings have value. They have the right to self-determination. They've made the choice to work in nonprofit because that's what they're passionate about. And if they're talented and good at what they do, you want to keep them. The number of really good nonprofit staff that I've seen leave for corporate positions, or if they've started their own businesses, because they just cannot sustain themselves on a nonprofit salary, is sad. It's really sad. And I think that opens up a whole new avenue of expenses for individual nonprofits, because continually bringing on staff because you have a revolving door, because people can't make a reasonable living income. The cost of that on the organization in terms of institutional knowledge, in terms of the time that it's taken to train somebody and the disruption of service every time somebody leaves, is huge. And you may not see that as a dollar cost, but it's certainly an opportunity cost in terms of what you could be doing with that time also. You know, I see a lot of people a lot of nonprofits who will create a job description that is the job description for a development director, say in fundraising, but they'll call it a development coordinator so that they can pay it a lesser salary. If you want a development coordinator, hire a development coordinator. That's an entry-level position the person's going to be learning on the job, as opposed to somebody who comes in with 5 or 10 years experience and is able to hit the ground running. You're going to be paying them more, but the return on investment is going to be higher. And I think absolutely nonprofit executive teams get that, but that's a conversation that needs to happen with donors so that they understand too. So I think that is really important. And then the other part of it that we spoke about also was what not-for-profit means. Not-for-profit doesn't mean that your expenses and your revenue have to cancel each other out at the end of the year and you come to a zero balance sheet. What you're looking at is you want a surplus. You want to bring in more money than you spend. The difference between for-profit and non-profit, obviously, is for-profit that's distributed to investors or shareholders as dividends or income. With nonprofits, it's held as surplus. And so it's put into savings or it's put into investment. But that's what you use either as a principal, if you have enough of it to earn your interest that is going to help you with operating costs, or to expand or increase your capacity, whether it's by hiring more staff or by increasing the reach of your programs or adding new programs to serve your clients. Or what I see a lot of boards do is say, paying our staff and giving them health insurance is one of our top priorities. But every time there's a surplus, it goes to something further down on the list. So then it's not a priority, right? So if you think it's a priority, say it's a priority. I've worked with a couple of organizations that have done staffing campaigns, salary campaigns, where they have specifically fundraised to add an extra program manager so that they're able to better deliver on their services. And if you articulate why you need that money to pay a salary, and you create a compelling enough case in terms of the impact that can have, donors don't have a problem with that. And I think particularly among smaller nonprofits, there's this perception that asking for money, particularly to pay yourself and your staff, but any kind of ask, if you're not a fundraising person, is akin to a personal ask. So you're kind of going cap in hand and saying, would you mind, excuse me, but do you think you could, anything you can give would be great. So you're kind of going from this almost an appeal that you're making coming from a place of feeling like you don't really deserve it and like you're asking someone to do you a favor, rather than going in like full of confidence and passion and inspiring them to invest in this mission that is so worthy because of the great things that you do. As people, we work for these organizations, we know that. So let's speak with what we do about what we do with pride and with reverence and with passion about why this is important to us, so that it becomes a conversation about investment and not a conversation about charitable donation or doing us a favor or kind of throwing us some change and we'll take whatever we can get. And a part of that conversation is salaries. When you talk to your donors and when you talk to your boards and your executive staff too, know that they're worthy that having the best staff, that paying them and having the best staff that you can attract is the biggest return of investment you can have for your organization in terms of how effective you are and how much you're able to achieve.
Mm-hmm. So. For those listening that still don't agree with Kate and I and how we're looking at this, just look to the NFL. Up and through 2015, the NFL was a nonprofit. You have a team and your lead running back has got traded away and you want to bring in some good quality talent. You're not going to bring in the 38-year-old broken down running back who was a number two the whole time. You are going to spend the big bucks and get yourself the top free agent running back to really bolster your team and do good things. doesn't do you any good to bring in the old guy to hope to maybe get a couple of yards. You want to win. You want to deliver your services. You got to bring in the best running back to make this thing happen. If you go out and you want to hire a consultant to help your nonprofit get stronger, me, Kate, or anyone else that we've had on the show, you're not going to want someone that's been doing this for 6 months and doesn't have any nonprofit experience. You might like their pay, their price tag, right? Oh, I've only got to pay $25 for this service. Well, great, because I've got 26 and I can make that happen. You know, you hear some really quality nonprofit consultants out there, you hear the price tag associated with them, you're like, oh, I don't know if I can make that happen. Well, first off, you don't have to say yes. But what you can do is you could bring that to your board, and the board would decide if that would be a good idea or not a good idea. But it's not a one-time event. If you have consulting come in, they're going to teach you all the things that you're going to be able to use for the lifetime of your organization, which is just beyond measure what the return on investment in that is. But what does, going back to hiring an employee, what does a nonprofit need to do? Does it have to say in their bylaws that they can hire people? What does that look like for the official paperwork?
No, I don't think so. I think that if you have a nonprofit that already has staff, that's run under the auspices of the executive director who's responsible for operations, and that's not something that goes into the bylaws. What would go into the bylaws is whether or not you can and how you hire an executive director and terminate an executive director if that's required. That is the only position that I think needs to be articulated in the bylaws. If you are entirely volunteer run or you're a small organization and you don't have an executive director yet and you would like to get yourself to a point where you can pay an executive director, I think you can amend the bylaws when you're ready to do that. And that would be your standard hiring and firing language that you would put into your bylaws for an executive director, as well as kind of what the performance review interval is, who conducts the performance review and how that's communicated to the executive director, and what performance improvement, if any, is required, is managed. That can all go into the bylaws. But in terms of who it is, how much they get paid, those are not things that need to be in bylaws. I'm all for having articulated documents like that be the least amount of restriction as possible so that you have the room to be able to move, but not so loosely worded that anything could be interpreted as being able to do anything. But I do think that in terms of hiring additional staff, particularly if they are relatively senior and costly hires, that goes into strategic planning. So when you have a strategic plan and you're looking at 3 to 5 years out and you know that you want to increase the capacity of your staff, whether that's with your first hire or another executive hire or a program hire, that is in your strategic plan, so that you have an accompanying financial fundraising plan that is going to illustrate how you're going to meet the cost of that. And, you know, meeting the cost of giving health insurance to your employees when you haven't before, or giving them a 5% raise to give them a more competitive salary, that is approached in terms of fundraising as anything else that you do at your organization, whether it's a special project or it's operating cost that gets incorporated into your budget. You fundraise the same way. You focus on the impact that is going to have for your client, and you focus on the outcomes that is going to deliver for your organization, rather than needing to pay somebody else. That's how you create the compelling case for it, I think.
Absolutely, Kate. I'd like to thank you so much for the insight you provided and for making time to me today. And I know you all can't see this, but Kate and I are matching. We're both wearing red today. It was very exciting, unplanned, and just glad to see Kate and all her brilliance. Kate, where can the people get a hold of you if they want more information, your services, or want to find out where that great accent came from?
Sure. So I'm on LinkedIn as Kate Redfern. It's CateRedfern, or at AntoniaConsulting.com. That's a little harder to wrap your tongue around. So you can find that on my LinkedIn profile, or just Google Kate Redfern Nonprofit. But yeah, it's Kate with a C. Just one last thing that I'd like to say, Travis, is if somebody's going to hire a consultant, you were talking about earlier, what they bring to the table. I think a really important question for any board or executive director who's going to hire a consultant to ask is what tools the consultant is going to leave with the organization to be able to continue to solve problems on their own, so that a consultant doesn't become a crutch for the organization every time they have a problem, to have it be process solution oriented rather than individual problem oriented, I think is really important, and to have conversations around that. I tell my clients that the best outcome I can have is to work myself out of a job because they no longer need me and I've done my job properly. And so I'd like to see more boards and executive directors having those conversations with contractors that they bring in.
Absolutely. It's not like American pharmaceuticals where they just get you healthy enough until you get sick again. That's kind of a jab at them, but maybe I'll have that edited out. I don't know. But thanks for being on the show today. Glad to have you. If you're listening to this, hey, share, like, rate, review, all that fun stuff. And you're interested in having conversations like this in a roundtable format or a mastermind, send an email to nonprofitarchitect@gmail.com with the title of your email saying mastermind. Get on this. We're launching soon. More to come on our site. Thanks, Kate. And thank you all.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.